Our first speaker is Dr. Geraldine Gorman. She's speaking on exploring the role of hospice nursing in a surgical center for civilian victims of war. She's a faculty member in the Department of Public Health, Mental Health, and Administration at the School of Nursing at University of Illinois at Chicago. And she's practiced as a hospice nurse and has volunteered with emergency services for 8 years. Our second speaker is Suzanne Hancock. She's speaking on health impact of locating a full-service grocery store in a low-income urban neighborhood. And Suzanne is with Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health and is a manager of student and community affairs and doctoral student there. And she was part of a project team for health impact assessments that was completed as part of a course. And our third speaker is Dr. Nancy Rothman, who's with Temple University, Department of Nursing, College of Health Professions and Social Work, also with the Independence Foundation as a professor of urban community nursing in Philadelphia. And her background is she's been the National Nursing Center Consortium at Temple University dealing with shared decision making, and the project has been part of nurse-managed primary care centers in Philadelphia. And our last speaker has changed. It'll be Dr. Eckhard Kleinau. He's the vice president for GRM Futures Group and involved with their Centers for Program Science, and that's based in Washington, D.C. So let Dr. Gorman begin. Thank you.
Okay, this is my disclaimer. Good morning. As mentioned, for the past 14 years, I've been full-time faculty at the College of Nursing at UIC, teaching, among other courses, the public health nursing class. For the same number of years, I've also practiced as a part-time hospice nurse. And since 2006, I have volunteered with the humanitarian war relief organization, Emergency. These three distinct but related aspects came together in the summer of 2013, when, with the aid of an International Development Award from UIC, I visited Emergency's hospital in Kabul. I was originally drawn to the work of Emergency by the clear declaration of its founder, Italian war surgeon Gino Strada, that war is the number one threat to public health. I believe this as well, and since it was my government that had unleashed this long war upon an already besieged country, I had wanted to witness their work in Afghanistan. But I also brought with me the sensibilities and values of an American hospice nurse, and what appeared to me as a gap in the continuity of care I witnessed gave rise to the ethical dilemma I will speak to in a few moments. But first, I wanted to go through a very quick overview of the work Emergency has been doing since it began its operations in Afghanistan in 1997. And I'm going to go through these very quickly because I've got way too many slides, so with very little narration. They're very, very conscious of the external environment. They really consider it to be as big a part of their healing center as the work that goes on in the hospital. So many gardens, well tended. It was Ramadan when I was there. I was not allowed to take pictures when the families visited, but that's one of the prayer rugs that was left. Their outpatient department is what we would consider the emergency department. It's where all the new patients come in. Mass casualty plans are always a possibility and always planned for. Those are the triage tents, which are always set up on the grounds. There, again, their outpatient department, which would be our emergency department. Most of the patients do well with the excellent care that they're given and go on to rehab and discharge. They have an extensive physiotherapy program. This little boy you see still connected to his chest tubes there getting physical therapy. Their ICU, they have a 6-bed ICU, one of the few operational ICUs in Kabul. This little girl I will speak of in a few moments. I'm There's the little boy you saw in physical therapy disconnected from his chest tubes and out prowling the grounds. The kids spend as much time outdoors as they do indoors. The list of the patient census, you can't read it very well, but the admitting diagnosis varies from bullet injury, handgun injury, mine injury, and motor vehicle accident. These following slides are a little bit graphic, but it seemed important to show the effects of the mine injuries that are so common, particularly among the children. This was a little boy who came to the hospital with a mine injury. He's in the pediatric unit. The man closest to the camera was his father, who was coming down from the mountain village to visit him, was caught in crossfire and ended up also in the hospital with bullet injuries, but he was allowed to stay in the pediatric unit so he could be close to his son. I also spent a couple of days going up to there. They have three hospitals, one in Kabul, one in Panjshir, and one in Lashkarga. So this is the hospital up in the mountains in Panjshir. They do mostly pediatric and obstetric work up there. Most of their staff are international. That's a Czech pediatrician and an Italian midwife. Again, the patients are mostly babies, very, very little pediatric and maternal care available. Oftentimes, there's so many children that the mother can't stay with the children, so it's the grandmother who comes and stays with the kids, as was the case here. Emergency runs 40 first aid posts throughout the country of Afghanistan, and this was just a quick tour of some of them that we visited. The man on the left is the director of all the operations in Afghanistan, an Italian worker. Remnants of the Russian occupation. Just a few quick statistics from the time I was there. I was there in July and August of 2013, so a comparison in the increase in the violence from January of 2013 to July of 2013. And they were and are, of course, bracing for what's going to happen when the last of the troops are withdrawn, although that's happening more slowly than had been anticipated. And I apologize for this slide. It came very late when I was getting my slides organized. It's a comparison between the increase from 2010 to 2014. So that first column you can see right there is 2010, and then the last column is the increase to 2014. Just a few of the patients. Thank you. actually 95% of the time the audio doesn't work, so I hadn't been expecting that that was going to play. That came as a surprise. Okay, quickly. I came away from my brief time in Afghanistan more deeply impressed than ever by the work of Emergency, the services they provide, the quality of their work and facilities, and the dedication of their staff. But I also left a little bit haunted by the lack of resources available to care for the dying. In areas of conflict, a triage mentality perhaps necessarily predominates. Nonetheless, there were three situations which occurred during my short stay which raised questions pertaining to rights, entitlement, and privilege. Early in my stay, a car arrived at the outpatient department driven by a father transporting his 17-year-old son who had been wounded early that morning. The young man had a bullet wound with an entry point in his thigh which he had sustained in a village high up in the mountains. They had been driving for many hours to reach the hospital, stopping at some of those first aid points along the way to get the dressing changed or reinforced. When they arrived, the teenager was weak and in pain, but alert and coherent. He was taken to surgery and then to the ICU. Over the next 24 hours, his condition worsened, and it was clear he had become septic during the long trip down through the mountains. The staff did what they could while the father squatted outside the hospital on the noisy and congested city street, coming in to stand by his son's bedside during the allotted visiting hours. He looked utterly lost as his strong and beautiful teenage son died slowly in the foreign environment of the ICU. The girl, which I mentioned in the slides, was a few beds down from him. She was a victim of a motor vehicle accident, and she sustained irreversible brain damage. She was ventilator-dependent and was allowed to remain in the ICU because her uncle was one of the ICU nurses there. She was there during my entire time, and there was no clear plan as to how to manage her impending death. Her large and distraught family would take turns sitting and crying at the bedside. The last night of Ramadan was the busiest and the most violent. The hospital was one admission short of enacting their mass casualty plan. At 11 p.m., all of us from the emergency lodgings across the street were called over to the hospital to be on alert in case the plan went into action. Amidst the chaos of the outpatient department, the director led me to a back storeroom where a young boy lay on a bear cot. He had a lethal head wound, and after it was determined he could not be successfully treated, he was left unattended as the staff scrambled to save lives. He was perhaps 14 years old, and his thick black hair was matted, dried blood covered his upper torso. I washed his face, his arms, and his chest, and sat with him until the outpatient department was emptied and the patients were either in surgery or transported to the appropriate wards. At that point, two of the local Afghan CNAs came in to get him. They lifted him from the cot to a gurney where they proceeded to hose down the rest of his body. They did not speak English, and I do not speak Farsi, so when I tried to protest, the one attendant stated simply, DNR. Yes, I said, but he is still alive. The next morning, I left for Panjshir, and when I returned 2 days later, he was gone. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, upon which Emergency is founded, recognizes the inherent dignity of the individual and proclaims that all are free and equal in our human rights. It prohibits torture and recognizes the personhood of each individual, presumably through the lifespan until the last breath is drawn. In the U.S., according to 2013 statistics from the National Hospice and Palliative Care Association, approximately 1.6 million people received hospice services with a median length of stay of 19 days. The recipients of care are still overwhelmingly Caucasian, approximately 80%. The hospice organization with which I proudly practice offers complementary therapies such as massage, Reiki, Shiatsu, aroma, and hydrotherapies. We have our own freestanding hospice unit with balconies that overlook a cultivated prairie with a stream and water birds. We have not one but three music thanatologists, harpists who compose music sitting at the bed of the dying. Small intimations of progress can be gleaned. The International Association of Hospice and Palliative Care lists as a member Hamdari Hospice in Kabul, which, from its website, lists home care, but the details are sketchy and communication with that hospice has been very fragmented. Afghanistan held its first palliative care conference in Kabul in 2013. It was organized by the Afghan Society Against Cancer, and it took place at the Kabul Medical Center. So there is some semblance of an organized response to the gaps in the services provided, but how this affects the war wounded remains unclear. So still, the discrepancies and the inequities in global end-of-life care remain breathtaking. In its position statement on nurses' roles in providing care to dying patients and their family, the International Council of Nurses mandates that it is our ethical duty to decrease suffering and increase end-of-life, increase the quality of end-of-life for dying patients. The quality end-of-life care is a luxury ill afforded by nonprofit organizations, which must conserve their precious resources for the good of those who can be saved, is yet more evidence of the truth of Geno Strada's declaration that war is the ultimate threat to public health throughout the lifespan. In a communication that arrived after I'd already sent my slides to APHA, Emergency's medical director in Kabul sent me the stats on hospital mortality rates thus far. Because of their stellar facility and the dedicated staff, the vast majority of patients do live and go on to rehab. Nevertheless, in 2012, 117 individuals died during hospitalization. In 2013, there were 91, and thus far in 2014, there have been 97 inpatient in-hospital fatalities. As citizens of a country that pledged support of the Declaration of Human Rights, we are mandated to uphold these patients' right to a dignified life and death, and as nurses, we are bound by our international affiliation to decrease suffering and to ensure a peaceful transition. The quality and manner of death in conflict zones remains an ethical minefield, and it challenges us to work all the harder toward the prevention of war and its relentlessly devastating sequelae. Thank you.